Previously on Wisco Weekly, we featured the CEO of Merchants Fleet, the eighth largest fleet management company in the world. As more technology is being applied to everyday tasks, one of their primary initiatives is to begin operating more like a tech company, or as Brendan likes to call it, fleet tech. However, this transition is not a switch that is flipped on, and suddenly overnight, Merchants Fleet becomes a tech company. One of the challenges in transforming the culture of a 50-year-old company is to fight the status quo, or as Brendan was taught, fixedness.
I went and took an innovation program. I've always brought innovation to all the companies I was at. And I said, you know, here's a company that I'm probably going to have to, you know, bring my A game to really help them innovate more.
Can you share this innovation program?
Yeah, it was an innovation. It was at Columbia University. It was with a company, Systemic Inventive Thinking, a gentleman by the name of Yoni Stern. And the term that they used is fixedness. And the term comes from almost the more industry experience you have, the more fixedness you have.
Yes.
So this is where, you know, as a new CEO, you go to a company and say, have you tried this? And they go, oh, no, that this is how we do it here.
I can tell you firsthand that fixedness has dug in its claws throughout the public sector. Having worked at UC Irvine and UCLA, the ability to create and innovate and constantly find ways to appeal to your audience generally moves at a sloth's pace. One reason for it? Fixedness. On this episode, we hear from the head of autonomous mobility at INRIX, Mr. Avery Ash. Avery is a 24/7 mobility enthusiast. Whether he is speaking at an event like he did at TechCrunch, or he is going for a jog in his hometown of DC, his mobility light is always switched on. Stay tuned to hear from Avery and how INRIX is helping public agencies to think more like private sector companies, and to avoid the pitfalls of fixedness. Before we get to Avery, listeners, let me share with you another listener car buying story. Brian from Rancho Mission Viejo sent us a text message from a car sales professional. Brian is in the market for a new truck, and after much online research, he is at the point of finding the best deal. After visiting his local dealership and test driving the truck he wants, he did what most savvy car buyers do, and that is to leave the dealership, think about it, and then engage in negotiation on his time. Naturally, one of Brian's first questions to the sales professional is, "What's your best deal?" In response, the sales professional, who has been trained from decades old of car industry negotiating tactics, writes, "People call in all the time to get numbers and then call other dealerships and then they go there. Happens all the time every day. If you're serious, which I think you are, I hope you see my side. My manager said, where is he?" And the sales professional concludes the message with, "I can give you a breakdown, but I need an appointment time as well." This is a classic negotiation where each party is extracting information out of one another and trying to get one person to commit to some action. In order for Brian to get what he wants, that being the best price, the sales professional needs him to come into the store. There are many ways to respond to this type of negotiation. Stay tuned for the end of this episode and hear how we advise Brian to handle this. Now, let's get into the show.
You are now tuned in to the Wisco Weekly Experience.
Mabuhay, bienvenidos, welcome, vitate, this is Wisco Weekly. We are tuned in to San Jose, California at TechCrunch Mobility. Rudy, my transportation correspondent, good friend, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, Dennis, I'm fine. I'm really digging the new opening, man. I love the way you say welcome.
We're welcoming people all around this world here, and our guest today is a seasoned veteran of the mobility space, and we're going to have a very, very interesting discussion. He's done the podcast circuit. If you've listened to some of the other mobility podcasts, which I've had a chance to tune in slightly to some of those. He's been on all of them, but we're going to hopefully talk about something he hasn't talked about, and that is about himself. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show the head of autonomous mobility at INRIX, Mr. Avery Ash.
Thank you very much.
Avery, how are you, sir?
Doing well.
How do you feel after your panel?
I feel great. We've been working up to our product announcement today, and I'm very happy to now have it officially in the past and move forward to the fun stuff, which is getting out and talking about it.
Well, it was a bit. Did you feel like it was a bit contentious on the stage there with Salita Reynolds?
No, I mean the work that Salita's doing with MDS, I think, is really pretty complementary and exists in the same extended universe of mobility data that Road Rules does. I know there's been a lot of dialogue around some of the fundamental questions that apply to the mobility data specification that Salita and LADOT and a number of other cities have been working on, but that kind of exists outside of the foundational work that we've been looking to do with our previously AV Road Rules and now Road Rules product, which is much more about helping cities to build the sorts of foundational data that's necessary to support new mobility options, whether those are automated vehicles at some point in the future, or today supporting, you know, consumers looking for parking, supporting TNCs looking for pickup and drop-off locations, or bikes and scooters looking to figure out where you should find or leave those vehicles.
Would you say there was one question that I thought was it? Salita brought up a lot of interesting points, but there was one question that towards the end there, Avery, where she said she would like to figure out how cities can get private companies to think like a city to solve its problems. Would you say that this new deployment of the road rules, when you were constructing it, putting together, that you were trying to think like a city to solve some problems?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the genesis for the work that we've done came out of my participation in the World Economic Forum's working group for automated and urban mobility. And you know, the focus of that is bringing together public sector and private sector to have conversations about, you know, what does this future of mobility look like with the particular tilt toward automated vehicles? And WEF's work, the World Economic Forum's work, was initially focused in Boston. So outside of the kind of broader conversations about, you know, policy implications and consumer engagement that go along with setting up a pilot of multiple vehicle operators on public roads, had a chance to have some pretty candid conversations with those same operators and with cities who were thinking about this topic. And one of the pieces, in addition to consumer education and consumer engagement, that came up was this kind of very, very immediate challenge of how does a vehicle in operation know what the rules are for the road that it's operating on. That's a traditional and pretty fundamental role of a road authority or the city, is setting what the rules are and communicating those out to road users. Historically, that's been the kind of road paint, road signs that work okay, except for when the road paint wears off or the road signs are incorrect or vandalized or knocked over. And in the absence of a digital record of that information, you know, vehicle operators build that themselves. It's costly, it's imprecise, and vehicle operators don't love it. But from a city perspective, you know, that watching that traditional role of being the steward of rules for the roadway be eroded in a new environment, you know, leads to some of that dissonance and some of the consternation that I think has driven some of the really big policy dialogues over the last handful of years, which is cities becoming a little bit worried that they're being left out of the conversation, that they don't have the tools necessary to engage with new technologies, whether those are scooters, automated vehicles, TNCs, you know, human drivers hunting for parking, whatever those look like. You know, our take, though, was rather than try to solve the over-the-horizon challenges, let's solve an immediate challenge, which is, okay, the solution to this, you know, to this data gap is fill the data gap. And from our perspective, there's really only one party that can and should be filling the gap of what are ground truth rules, what applies on this roadway, and that's the city, or that's the road authority. So what we provide is a tool for them to actually create that asset that they can then manage and share as they see fit.
Yeah, so a lot of things that you're talking about here really reference the conversations you're having with cities, but you have a extensive background in working with policymakers,
yep,
be it not just with INRIX, but with AAA.
Yep.
And then with also you were serving as the...
So I was on Capitol Hill for a couple of years, and those at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce prior to that.
Yeah. So what are the conversations like now when you talk with federal regulators or policymakers? I mean, again, if we're talking about traffic signs and the safetiness of how traffic moves, yes, I could see those are more city conversations. what are the conversations like at the federal level?
There's been a lot of policymaker education, much in the same way that there's frankly been stakeholder education necessary of, you know, before you can have a substantive conversation about how do you appropriately support and drive this sort of innovation, you need to be on the same page of what's the lexicon you're using. And as recently as, you know, the last couple of years, many policymakers still are lacking the kind of fundamental understanding of how do these systems, automated driving systems, how do they work? What do they do? What don't they do? How quickly are they going to come to market? And in the absence of good, sound, realistic information about the technology, a lot of these kind of tempest in a teacup sorts of stories take off. And you get these really long-term heaven or hell type scenarios being bandied around as, you know, the reason why we need to push for a federal bill is because automated vehicles are going to mean accessibility for everyone. They might, but they're not going to in the near future. They may eventually, and it's important that we create some guardrails around or some tracks for the technology to run on that ultimately work toward that goal, much in the same way that, you know, there, you hear this kind of this, this is going to put, one of the big pushbacks at the federal level has been on the for automated commercial trucking from a truck driver perspective is, you know, is this going to mean the job of truck driver goes away overnight? And in the absence of data and dialogue surrounding that, I mean, I think that's an understandable question to have of, okay, driverless is there in the name. So if there's no driver, does that mean there's no job? And it takes a good deal of education now at the federal level in particular to really have a productive conversation around, we currently have so truck driver shortages, we'll take that as an example. Let's look at the reality check on. So what would it actually mean to remove the driver from the vehicle? Does that mean that there is no longer a driver participating in the act of commercial trucking at all? No. It may mean that there are stretches of road, at least in the near term, where a vehicle would be able to operate in automated driving mode. Doesn't actually remove the driver from the equation. All it does is changes the role. And that you actually may see scenarios where you have more jobs available, then more high paid technical jobs to meet the needs of new technologies. And the other part of that is, you know, we currently have a truck driver shortage in this country. And there is a lack of participation in that market that's leading to, you know, to a gap between drivers needed and services wanting to be provided. So this technology can actually serve to advance a lot of the same goals. I think many people are concerned that they might actually undermine.
When you're dealing with policymakers at the federal level, now comes the instance of data privacy protection and sharing. Obviously,
absolutely.
GDPR has set the standard for what a lot of U.S. states will follow.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those federal policymakers are going to somewhat follow in suit. But then that also now starts to take you down the path where that could intertwine or possibly combat with some of the cities and mm-hmm. what they want. For instance, Salida Reynolds, and again, I started to keep referencing, but like I think she almost represents the polar opposite of what a city would want. She wants the collection of raw data
mm-hmm.
to which you, Enrix, you know, let's say you two are one and the same. You, Enrix, are one and the same with this Road Rules product.
Mm-hmm.
That is a lot of data you are collecting there. Would you be prepared to share raw data?
Yeah, I mean, the model for Road Rules is that the city is actually building their own data set.
That'd be good then. So they're just getting their own data.
Right. So and the structure of it is that, you know, it's a city goes through this process of building out, validating, and managing their own data set. And our model is much more about how do you share that information with consumers, with end users, with automated vehicles, with constituents, or interagency. So how do you have a kind of a central catalog for data assets that can be distributed? You know, most cities that we work with have some sort of a charge or commitment to making the data that they have open. So we've built, you know, fundamental to our platform has been our partnership with Shared Streets, which is an open data specification project by the National Association of City Transportation Officials. That's an open reference language. So anybody can access it. Anybody can use it. It promotes interoperability. It promotes open data exchange. And, you know, that's the structure for our API is, listen, the city has gone through this work of building out this data set. It's available to any road user to access to get a better understanding. So, and I think that's kind of where there's a, when I said in the beginning, like this is kind of the extended universe of city data We exist in the same world as MDS, but the conversations around MDS are somewhat distinct from the sorts of challenges that we're looking to address.
Avery, previously you mentioned the fact that one of the things, it sounds like Road Rules does many things, but one of the things that Road Rules will do is create a digital footprint for, you were saying, some striping and some some other type of sensors perhaps, or something that was there. I love hearing that the digital footprint's going to be built out, because what I have been arguing literally for years in articles, years on the articles in that I've written on this podcast, at a local government, a city local government conference in California 3 years ago, was we need to AVs are already there. You can go onto YouTube. You can already see automated vehicles driving, right? Mm-hmm. If you can spend hours doing that. Mm-hmm. The AVs are here. However, we're never going to get to like this utopian future where truck drivers aren't driving and people aren't driving and people are sleeping in their cars unless we redo our infrastructure. Mm-hmm. If I'm hearing what you're saying correctly, Road Rules in a way provides like some gap filler, because the permanent sensors are not there, the perfect paint isn't there, because the infrastructure isn't there yet, Road Rules can provide some filling of the gap so that automated vehicles can actually be dispersed and be a part of our society?
Yeah, Road Rules is really a foundational approach to longer term smart cities. So you got to start with having good data. And right now, for many cities, the reason why they may not have accurate, digital, easily shareable records for, let's say, parking restrictions or intersection designs is not a lack of an interest in having that data. It's a lack of tools to actually build that data set. So you end up with, in the scenario we have now, where you may have multiple, best case scenario, GIS files that note location of road assets. But more often than not, we're talking about things like a spreadsheet or pen and paper designs for intersections and binders there's no mechanism. There hasn't been a mechanism, though, to build that digital layer that we're now seeing the appetite from cities of, if I can manage this all in one place, this opens up a whole new world of ways I can think about and visualize my city and innovations that can be built on top of that much better data set.
I admire what you said, because I've got a very close friend, Dennis knows him too. He created a company to help cities with debt management, to get them out of spreadsheets and onto the cloud and a little bit of
Andrew
digital.
Flynn, Acorn,
Andrew
right?
Flynn of Acorn. And he's had a really hard time convincing cities, when cities go to, Excel works perfectly fine. Yeah. Are you seeing the same thing when you're trying to put in something like Road Rules, or is it because transportation is here, it's in their face, and it's such an important issue that cities are focusing on it?
No, I mean, I think there's a real appetite to graduate, to move toward a digital recording of these sorts of rules and assets, because if you're on a daily basis forced to deal with the challenges of having kind of legacy systems or legacy approaches to recording these sorts of rules and restrictions that a city has, having that exist in one place that can be easily updated, shared, and managed, it makes a city manager or a city user's life that much easier to have it in a 21st century approach to that sort of historically pen and paper task.
It must be the disconnect then between people that do traditional finance, like I'm an infrastructure finance lawyer, and it's just kind of an older industry, versus the city. I know, man. I could put everybody to sleep here if I told them about my day job, versus the traffic engineers, the city managers, the people that are dealing with the day in day, the jobs that sound a lot more fun. Maybe there's a disconnect there.
Yeah, I mean, and part of the challenge, I think, maybe that you'd mentioned that spreadsheets, they work just fine for the areas you're talking about. Spreadsheets may work just fine for transportation. They don't. And there's a broad recognition that it's how we have to do things. It's how we have been doing things, because there's no better solution. But boy, we wish there was.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting.
So going back to Road Rules here. So the concept, as you've explained already, you're allowing the city to input their own data that is otherwise perhaps in a spreadsheet.
Yep.
And now, bring some automation, bring some understanding to it, and then eventually getting to the point where you're sharing it with automakers and TNCs and whatnot. Although with Road Rules right now, because it is new, the only automaker you have that I saw was Jaguar Land Rover. Mm-hmm. I mean, so on one hand, you do have more adoption of cities implementing that software, but on the other side of the equation, in order for that data to be comprehensive in the ecosystem, you need the other side of it, that being the automaker, so that it can actually collect the data and see the potholes, no?
Or yeah, I mean, there is some amount of that data flow coming back to the cities that I think remains to be explored. But the first and fundamental challenge to address has been the data moving from the city to a vehicle in operation. And you know, the listed supporters we have when we launched last year of Jaguar Land Rover, May Mobility, and Aptiv Nutonomy, which you know I would argue are also leaders in this space. Mm-hmm. They're not traditional automakers, but they certainly have vehicles on public roads now that are, you know, ahead of where many OEMs are in their testing and deployment schedules, and then vehicles on the Renovo platform as well. Is that these are companies and organizations that have committed to using this data where it's available. We've had a lot of conversations though offline with, you know, the full gamut of other vehicle operators who, you know, you have to join the program in order to get access to it. It's an open API. So, you know, for Las Vegas to go through this process of building out their data set for the initial Fremont Street test that the Keolis Navya AAA shuttle, you know, none of those three organizations is an official participant in the Road Rules platform, but they have access to that data just the same as a you know an Aptiv or a Jaguar or whomever. So I think you know there are opportunities down the line to, you know, formalize those partnerships for data coming back about pothole location or worn lane striping or missing adequate signage, to formalize those relationships, bringing that data back to the city. But for now, the focus has really been about on the city side, you need their buy-in first and foremost, and you need them to do the legwork, the foundational work necessary to actually to make this system start to hum. And then you can start having those conversations about, okay, what's the data that a city really wants to have or needs to have? And, you know, as we discussed earlier on the panel today, and why? You know, what are the use cases for data coming back in? Pothole data, we get it. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. You know, when we started having conversations about potholes, though, the initial piece was we want data about potholes. And when you start to break it down, it's not really data about potholes. No city wants to have a dump of LiDAR information about here's the structure of all these potholes that they can't do anything with. What they would prefer is to have information about where there are potholes and some amount of information about severity. So we're trying to advance that conversation from just a data exchange to an information exchange.
I got a question about that. So what does Road Rules do with respect to identifying potholes, finding their location? I mean, how do you locate it and then provide that data to the city?
So we have the functionality for a vehicle in operation to report back through our platform to flag the location of missing worn lanes or inadequate lane striping, location of a pothole that is impacting the ability for that vehicle to operate safely. The metrics around what constitutes a severe pothole versus a, you know, if you're driving, I live in Washington, D.C., if you're driving in D.C. and you're reporting every pothole, you're going to be inundated with data at the city level that's just, frankly, pretty useless.
Yeah.
What you want is what are the really severe potholes that are going to injure somebody or break someone's vehicle.
And how would you identify that? Would you do it with a picture?
It would be geotagging. So noting this section of roadway, this many meters from the previous intersection in this lane, there is a pothole.
That's cool. You ever heard of a company called Tip Tags?
Yeah.
They do like map.
Yeah, yeah.
They do map based messaging. Yeah. And they're kind of in that space and not in your space, not competing, but it's almost like it would be like a good marriage.
Yeah. And
the two.
And there was some discussion, right, of like, okay, how precise do you need to get for that information?
Correct.
And again, that comes back to the use case. Well, the use case here would be the city is alerted that there's a really severe pothole. They send out a road crew to fill that pothole. The road crew doesn't need to know to the sub-centimeter level where that pothole is. They'll show up and they'll find it.
Right.
I mean, you can get them within a couple of meters and that's fine. And that's very different from the approach that HD map developers and providers have been taking, which is, you know, sub-centimeter level precision of what does the physical world look like. We've been much more focused on the abstract layer that overlays the roadway, which is what are the rules that apply to this road. It's not about where's the location of a stop sign or what's the location of a speed limit sign. It's about what is the speed limit on this road, what is the requirement to stop or to yield at this intersection. Not about precise location of signs. I mean, signs aren't rules. Signs are a the traditional way to communicate a rule to a human driver. We've taken the approach that there are better ways to communicate rules to a digital system, to an automated driving system, and frankly, to humans who are using smartphone navigation and at some point in the near future, you know, either augmented reality or head-up displays, to be able to overlay the sort of information that makes everybody drive safer and more efficiently and more effectively.
That's great.
Let me put you in another position here, because I get the fact that you're you bleed Enric's blood right now. I can hear it. It's infectious. Let me put you in the position of a VC. Mm-hmm. A governor or mayor, you mm-hmm. know, in that role, knowing everything that you know now, mm-hmm. If you're in charge, you said you're in DC. So mm-hmm. let's just say you in your own home city, you are looking to have a AVs deployed. What is the minimum viable product that you would want to see
for a vehicle?
I
think the match for that is the use case that you're looking to apply it to. So if you're looking at if the goal of if I'm in, let's say I'm mayor of DC, and my goal is I want to try to address first mile, last mile delivery. Okay. So goods delivery, not people delivery, then the companies I look to partner with are going to be a very different list than if I'm trying to do an augmentation to public transit. I've got great north-south bus service in Washington, D.C., not as good east-west. So are there opportunities to link? I would look more broadly than just automated vehicle. That's where, like, looking at what are the challenges you're facing as a city and then try to match it with technology versus trying to identify a technology and then figure out how to shoehorn it into services, right?
Yeah, it's this whole adage of you have a solution, now you're looking for a problem.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And I mean, there had historically been a lot of that in the AV space of, you know, cities who are eager to have an automated vehicle testing on their public roads, but hadn't really taken the next step of, you know, why? What's the goal? So this vehicle runs around for 6 months or a year. As people riding it, you get a ribbon cutting, you get a pretty good headline, you know, you make it onto the Aspen Institute Bloomberg Philanthropies map of cities that are doing AV testing, but there aren't metrics at the end of it to measure success for a program. So in my mind, you know, it makes me excited to see that cities that are now doing tests are starting to ask some fundamental learning questions of, you know, I want to either understand more about how this is going, how my constituents are going to interact with the service, or I have a problem that I think a technology you have may be able to help me solve. So, using the ability for scooters to deliver access to mobility, cheap access to affordable mobility to underserved populations is really exciting. But it requires the involvement of a city in that conversation to actually realize those sorts of benefits.
And, you know, listeners, make note of this. Avery is consistent through and through. You know, I'm trying to put him more in a individual position to communicate his own thoughts. But even about, correct me if I'm wrong, I think this came out about a year ago. Mm-hmm. You wrote a piece, and this is what it says. And this seems to be what you're talking about right now. You said, when I talk to a mayor's office about autonomous vehicles, more often than not, they want to know how they can get vehicles on their city streets as soon as possible. The rationale generally centers on one of two themes: the halo effect, the perception that AV testing will lure innovation, jobs, and dollars to the city, or two, the Instagram effect, the need to keep pace with peer cities whose mayors already have pictures riding in or cutting the ribbon on an AV pilot. What I hear cited much less frequently is the utility effect, a rationale tied to transportation or mobility needs, i.e. my city wants to use AVs to address blank challenge.
I'm relieved to hear that I stand by that. That sounds perfect.
Avery, I got a question for you. I mean, it sounds, just from what I'm learning about Enric's and road rules, this question is not really applicable per se to Enric's and road rules, but what are your thoughts, having done policy, having spent time in Washington, D.C., about the patchwork of legislation between federal and states with respect to autonomous vehicles? You know, you probably are well aware, towards the end of 2017, there was a bill. It had made it very far, and then New York, then followed up by people from L.A., kind of killed it because they wanted to keep, you know, more of the level 3, level 4, level 5 power at the city level. I'm not asking you to opine on that, but what do you think about the patchwork of legislation and how that's holding the United States back from, in my opinion, possibly being one of the leaders in the AV space. Because one thing that I see in countries that have,
China.
Well, just more authoritarian governments, not just China. There's a lot of government. There's a lot of countries out there that have that. Is, you know, you just go to one place to get the laws passed. Mm-hmm. How much do you think that's going to impede the development or rollout of AVs in the United States?
So impede the development, probably not a lot. Okay. Impede the rollout, absolutely.
Okay.
And I think part of it is leaving this task only to either state governments or city governments puts either mayors or governors or state department of transportation, city department departments of transportation in a position to need to be creating rules surrounding technology that they may not be familiar with. And I think that's kind of one of the parts of this conversation that doesn't get discussed enough. I mean, in California DMV was charged, early days of AV regulation, was charged with creating a licensing structure for AVs. And they were pretty clear up front that we don't really have the in-house expertise to know how to do this correctly. We are going to get it wrong. We're gonna do the best we can. And we're going to create a system that we think makes sense, but we know full well that we don't have the in-house resources or expertise to do this to the scale that absent federal leadership, to the scale that's going to be necessary to support broad adoption and rollout of this technology. And I think this is a healthy conversation to have between federal government, state government, city government around what are each individual entity's roles in this process. I think it's the concerns expressed by some of the city participants in that dialogue last year were around, am I losing my ability to engage with and deliver
provide the safety for our pedestrians?
Yeah,
am I
kind of losing control over my own streets?
Right.
And I think that thematically actually fits pretty well with what we've been doing too, though, which is, that is not only limited to concerns surrounding a federal bill that might preempt, maybe not by design, but preempt some city ability to engage with and manage traffic flow on their public right of way. But it's the same concern and challenge that cities have had with new technologies coming in, which is, I'm kind of worried I'm losing control here, and I'm not sure what the tools I have to actually actively engage with and to
be knowledge about it, so they can at least have an intelligent discussion with the technology provider.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, to try to get to the initial question you asked, like the patchwork challenge. I mean, it's a real challenge. It's something that I think we can and should address. But there are healthy parts of that conversation to be ironed out.
I think about AVs and the rollout of it and our transportation revolution, our future, a lot. You can go to listen to any of our podcasts here or other podcasts that I've been on. I think about it a lot. One thing that I've got an issue with is AVs being on the road with human drivers.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that the rollout of AVs should be on designated lanes.
Dedicated lanes,
et cetera, et cetera. Could INRIX help solve some of the planning or thinking about dividing AVs from human drivers? I mean, is that something it could provide?
I mean, maybe it's not something we've thought about to date. I think
I'm free right after this if you'd like to get some more thoughts.
No, I mean, I think the points are well taken on the potential safety challenges of having automated driving systems interacting with human drivers. But I think a lot of those challenges are the same of my concerns about having human drivers interact with human drivers.
Oh, I want to get rid of all human drivers, but take away our driver's licenses, you might even get more of a blowback than you do with the gun debate in America. Driving licenses are freedom. They're freedom.
Interesting.
It's freedom.
I don't know. According to what's her name, Sarah Smith at Bain Capital, when she was giving her panel,
the driver's
right?
license thing.
Yeah, she was quite surprised that there's just, and I guess that's what all the stats are saying, that there's just not a lot of the millennial generation, or even if there's a name for the generation after them, that they're not acquiring a driver's license anymore. And we've seen this in the automotive space with automakers and dealerships, where 5 years ago, there were stats saying that, wow, car sales, we're never going to hit peak car sales anymore because no one's driving anymore. They prefer to just ride share. They prefer to do these other things.
And they were wrong.
They were wrong.
Yeah.
You look at the data a year ago, there's now, you know, millennials are on pace to supersede a baby boomer.
It's crazy. I would never have thought that would have turned
out. Talk to the Human Driving Association. They've got lots to say on that.
I didn't know they have one. There's an actual Human Driving Association?
Yeah, Alex Roy, founder of it, is here today.
I'm going to have to
talk
to him about
this. Alex here today.
Alex here. I believe I saw him earlier. So
I would like
fantastic.
I would like to meet
him. So he's anti-cyborg. He's really worried about Skynet then.
I don't want to take his words, but he's been very active in the need to maintain a driver agency behind the wheel of a vehicle.
And going back to California's regulations, if you go and look back at the California regulations, they wanted the requirement of the AVs on their roads, at least initially for a number of years, that a human driver still sit behind the steering wheel and be able to take it over. Now they've loosened that up after a bunch of companies left California. They went to Phoenix. They went to where the laws were a little bit more liberal. Mm-hmm. But so I guess that kind of plays into the Human Driving Association. His philosophy ties into the prior, you know, approach of California and its AV regulations then.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Avery, you're very serious, bro. What do you like? You're obviously very, like, I can tell that this is a 7 day a week, not even job, but life for you.
Yeah.
To talk mobility, to look at it, to see what's going on, to collect your own thoughts and analyze and propose new ideas. But what the hell are you doing for fun?
That's a great question.
Is it going on to podcasts?
Outside of mobility? Listening to podcasts, for sure.
What's your favorite podcast? Favorite podcasts, maybe.
I mean, I don't want to plug a competitor. I love the Autonicast.
I heard you on Autonicast.
Listen
I heard
to
you
religiously.
On Mobility Podcast.
Yep.
And there was one more.
We've got our own thing. We have no competitors. You know, we have a wide swath of listeners, and we try to touch upon a lot of different audiences.
So Autonicast, what else?
Rewatchables from the Ringer Net, from the Ringer Network. They're fantastic. This American Life a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a big fan of that.
I'll listen to podcasts while I run. That's kind of my general podcast time. Run, flying, taking the bus.
It's great.
Those are your modes of transportation.
Yeah, I was worried. I was worried because I love podcasts. I really do. I learn a lot from them. Obviously, I'm on this one. I'm on a couple of other of them as guests. I've always only listened to podcasts when I'm in the car. For some reason, I can't walk or take public transportation and listen to a podcast. I have no idea why, which makes no sense because I can read and write on it. I'm glad to hear that you can run and you could do. So it sounds like any mode
of
transportation.
That's just because you're unathletic, bro. That's just
the only reason why
you haven't discovered.
It's very true, but I really do think that podcasts will not be effective if we do go to a driverless future where no one's driving. I hope that doesn't negatively impact podcasts. That's all what I'm saying, because then we'd be out of a job.
Won't somebody think of the podcasters? Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
I'm trying to.
Well, cool, Avery. Thanks so much for being on and dropping all your knowledge. We'll have to stay in touch and follow some of your progress. Hopefully, we'll see you either in political aspirations or perhaps some other kind of aspirations.
Great.
You had a lot of knowledge, bro.
Great. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Listeners, as we end every episode, cheers, prost, l'chaim, kipis, nastravi, salu, kampai, mabruk, tutsins, gambe, yamas, nastorovie. To the customer experience.
Hey listeners, I hope you enjoyed this episode with Mr. Avery Ash. Stay tuned for our final episode of this TechCrunch series, where we hear from Sion Phillips, the managing director of Planet M. Now, let's conclude Brian's car buying story. To revisit, Brian is in the heat of the negotiation battle with his local dealership of trying to obtain the best price on a truck he is interested in. After his inquiry on obtaining the best price, the sales professional countered with, "I can give you my best deal if you are able to schedule an appointment." Let me point out one fundamental premise both Brian and the sales professional are operating on, and that is they are both negotiating in good faith. Brian can easily schedule an appointment so that he gets what he wants, and then he could just flake. Similarly, the sales professional can offer him the deal of a lifetime, but upon showing up, change the deal entirely. Successful negotiations only work when all parties operate in good faith. So we advise Brian not to merely counter the sales professional's negotiation tactics, but to reflect inwardly and ask himself if this is indeed the truck he wants. Many a times, car buyers enter the car buying process to engage in negotiations simply to negotiate and to win. So sometimes winning trumps the reality of actually buying a car. Other times, car buyers are looking for the deal of a lifetime. And if that deal is not available, then the buyer never had any intention whatsoever of buying the car anyways. In Brian's case, he did take another moment of pause to reflect if that truck is indeed the truck he is most interested in. So, we will keep you posted. Tune in next week to Wisco Weekly and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and for our travels, follow us on Instagram. Thanks for tuning in.